Welcome to Populist. This is week two of our mega month for college football. I'm Steve Hafer. With me is Kirk Treutner. How you doing, Kirk?
Hey, everybody. How y'all doing?
So did you watch the national championship game since we're talking about all things college?
I watched a little bit of it. I was on the road helping my folks, but I listened to a lot of it. And boy, Alabama sure put an exclamation point on this season.
Yeah, I was a little disappointed in Ohio State's, I'm not going to say their effort, because I think they really tried, but their output, whatever happened, because they looked so good against Clemson. And I don't think Clemson was playing bad. I think Ohio State played really well, and I was anticipating a better game. I thought Alabama would win ultimately, but yeah, that was kind of surprising.
Yeah, we're on the same page here. I thought it would be a better game. I was very surprised at the final score. The fact that it was that kind of score, I guess, isn't surprising, but it was unexpected. But, you know, with Alabama, you know, anything's possible. I mean, that's just an awesome team.
Yeah.
And continues to be.
Yeah.
And will be for the foreseeable future.
Yeah. And even with all the dudes that they'll be losing in this offseason, you know, they're just waiting in the wings. So to pick against them would be foolish. I don't think you necessarily have to go and anoint them the preseason number one, because Clemson is still going to be very good. Georgia's on the uprise. Ohio State's still going to be good. Notre Dame's probably going to be good. You know, there's a lot of really good teams out there. But when the dust clears at the end of the season, if Alabama's in that position again, I'm not surprised.
I mean, it's a tough bet. Do you take Alabama or do you take the field?
Well, it's always tough to not take the field. And that's the old Tiger Woods thing. Vegas used to do that all the time. Tiger Woods versus the field.
Oh, yeah.
He's like, yeah, I'm taking the field because, yeah, Woods may beat me half the time, at least when he was on his hot streak, just like Alabama may. But you still got to think the odds are with you.
But oh, wow. Yeah, but the fact that we even have to consider it, I mean, it should just be a slam dunk. Take the field. If I said Cal or the field, of course you take the field. Yeah, if you take Oregon or the field, you take the field. But with Alabama, you know, you have to go, yeah, okay, the field.
But I think the bigger question on Cal versus the field is, would you take the field?
No, I would take Cal. Every time you take Cal.
That right there
just gives me legitimacy for the amount of drinking that I would do after the game.
Well, I was just going to call you a real fan, but okay, we'll go with the drinking aspect. Let's get into this week. This is week two of our mega month for college football, and it is for the best all-time college head coaches. Quite a list, a lot of guys to go through. And David Hale, our special guest, will be joining us later in the show. He was with us last week, the ESPN reporter, with some good insights, and I'm sure he'll have more to say on this subject as well. All right, so since I started last time, that means you start this week. So, Kirk Treutner, what is your number 10?
Number 10.
Well, this has been a fun category to work on this week. A lot of great research. Found out a lot of interesting things. And you know, like last week with the teams, you know, there's objective ways and subjective ways to look at coaches as well as teams. You know, there's a lot of numbers, winning percentages, national championships, all that. But then how do you take that and then subjectively rank these guys? So, you know, found out a lot about different coaches, found out a lot of different programs. So I'm going to jump into it by going all the way back, very beginning. My number 10 is Amos Alonzo Stagg. This is a coach who coached for more than 60 years, 548 decisions. At one point, he had the record for the most wins and the most losses by a college coach. But the reason I put him on the list, for the most part, not only was it a couple of national championships back in the early days, but he was one of the game's true innovators. I mean, he is the guy that came up with the reverse, with laterals, padded goalposts, the huddle, the position of linebacker. I mean, this guy was a true innovator of the game. He was there at the very beginning. He not only had these ideas, he put them into play and was very successful with them. Again, you know, 314 wins. He was also the first paid coach, which legitimized the coaching profession when he was coaching at the University of Chicago. So for all of these things, each of which contributed mightily to the game of college football, Amos Alonzo Stagg is the number 10 coach on my list.
Yeah, definitely gave him consideration. He didn't make my list. Famous for the first school I went to, University of the Pacific in Stockton, California. He was a coach there. They no longer have a program. Thanks, Amos. definitely an innovator. And guys like him and Pop Warner and Walter Camp, you know, who all brought so much to the actual physical game. They definitely need recognition. Good choice. My number 10 is from the school that I graduated from. It is John McKay from USC. Don't worry, Kirk. It's out of my system now. McKay, he's not the guy with the highest winning percentage. He's not the guy with the most wins. He's not the guy with the most national championships, but he really helped usher in the modern era of USC football and Pac-8 football. In fact, let's just say West Coast football. He kind of was responsible for putting them on the map. Even though Howard Jones was there at USC before, it still had floundered. West Coast football had floundered a little bit. Once McKay came in, established his style, established the way that they were going to play football and how it was different a little from the rest of the country. It was very tailback heavy, a lot of speed, a lot of flash. So he gets that. Yes, he still had a 749 winning percentage, 4 national championships, 9 conference titles. I think one of the things that I like most about him is he was part of the little gentleman's agreement between two coaches. Bear Bryant was getting a lot of flack in Alabama for not having an integrated team, as was all of the Southeastern Conference. He called his friend John McKay and said, hey, let's start off next year's season. What if you bring the Trojans out and play us here in Tuscaloosa, which they did. And USC beat them 42-21. And Sam Bam Cunningham, the black running back fullback for USC, had a field day, went huge. That display that they put on helped Bear Bryant then the next year start integrating his team. And by 3 years down the road, he had a third of his team were black athletes. And so that's a little moment of college history that I like. And I think John McKay was a big part of it. So that's my number 10.
Again, not being an SC fan, I always did admire McKay. I mean, they say it's easy to recruit to LA. I mean, you got the weather, you got the industry, you've got, you know, the Southern California reputation, but you still have to go out and do it. You still have to go out and get the guys. And McKay always had the guys. Every year, it just felt like there was wave after wave after wave of recruits. SC was a powerhouse. They were fun to watch. You know, even as a kid, when I wasn't as diehardly fervent against them as I was, it was fun to watch SC and a lot of the players you talk about that he coached. A lot of admiration for McKay. I also would have had great consideration where he did not make my list, but I also love the fact he had such a great relationship with the media.
Yeah.
And he was fun. He took the game seriously, but not overwhelmingly so. I just thought he was a great face for USC football and football on the Pacific Coast in general. So, you know, I agree with him going on your list. Didn't make mine, but I can absolutely see how he could make yours.
Yeah, he was kind of the first of the LA media era coaches for any of the sports teams, any of the college teams. You're very right.
Very media savvy. You're right.
So let's move on. Who's your number 9?
Number nine,
we're going to stay in the early part of the college football generation. Number 9, his name is known throughout the world, mainly because it's lent itself to youth football. This is Coach Pop Warner. That actually started off as a thing called Pop Warner Little Scholars. I think they've lost the scholar part of it over the years, but Pop Warner football is still a huge youth football program in the United States and across the world. 4 national titles, very well traveled. He was actually at 7 schools. He coached Jim Thorpe. Jim Thorpe was his first real superstar player when he coached at Carlisle. And like Amos Alonzo Stagg, an incredible football innovator. Warner was the one that came up with the single wing and the double wing, which were the precursors of the spread and the shotgun offenses. He came up with the 3-point stance, the hidden ball trick, blocking techniques. So again, my first couple really are coaches that not only had success on the field, but they influenced the game in its infancy and really started to shape what we enjoy now 100 years later. He did have a 730 winning percentage, won 336 games over his career. So he did have success as a coach. But Pop Warner is my number 9.
Hop. At least when we grew up, it seems like every kid knew that name and they didn't know really where it came from. And he's the man for sure. Didn't make my list, but under consideration for sure. My number nine, this guy for me could have been placed almost anywhere on the list. And that includes number one. You could make an argument for him for number one, I think. And that is Larry Karras of Mountain Union in Ohio. It's a Division III school, which is the reason that he ended up on number nine and not number one. But his accolades and his record definitely suggest otherwise. 332 wins, 24 losses, three ties over a 24-year period. That's a 929 winning percentage. That's a record. If you just took his Mountain Union, he's still 303 wins, 23 losses, and three ties. That's a 323, right? 12.2 wins a year average. 11 Division III national championships, another record. 23 conference titles, another record. 21 unbeaten seasons, another record. 66-11 in Division III playoffs. Had the most consecutive victories, which was 55 between 2000 and 03. He had a 3-1 record against John Gagliardi of St. John's, who had the most wins ever in college football. So he has a winning record against the winningest coach ever. Had winning streaks of 54 games, 55 games. This is just a coach's coach. He knows the game. Obviously got the most out of his squad. The fact that he was not in FBS is the reason that he stayed where he is on my list. But Larry Karras deserves recognition. My number nine.
Ooh, going deep on that one.
I like the small divisions. I like Division II and III a lot. Good stuff.
Well, I may dive into that pool in just a little bit as well.
But since you have the floor and we're talking about number eight, Kirk Treutner, what is that for you?
Number eight.
Generally on my list, the coaches that we're talking about have had long, illustrious careers. They've done it at multiple schools, et cetera. It just shows the depth and breadth of their coaching ability. However, number eight is the exception to that rule. Number eight is Frank Leahy, who was a coach at Notre Dame for a fairly short time. I mean, he was not there a great deal of time, but what an unbelievable record. 107-13-9. Five national championships. It was an 829 winning percentage. He played under Newt Rockne at Notre Dame and then coached them for 10 years later, built upon Rockne's success. And from 1946 to 1949, the Irish were 46-0-2. So if you think about that, if you were a freshman who enrolled in 1946, you never lost a game when you were at Notre Dame. That's pretty amazing. It was a short career. As he said, he was quoted saying, I drove my players hard. I drove myself even harder, and it forced him out of the game at age 45. So it was a streaking comet of a career, but you cannot deny the success that he had at a school that was really becoming a national brand at that point in time. Rockne had put Notre Dame on the map doing a first, and I'll talk about this a little bit later on when we talk about Rockne, but he was the one that first played a more national schedule and got the exposure of the university out on a national level instead of a regional level, which is where most of the games are being played at that point in time. And then Leahy built upon that. So Frank Leahy, 107 wins, five national championships, 46-0-2 for 4 years. He is my number eight.
Yeah. Once again, under consideration, did not make my list. I have to give a large percentage of his credit to Newt Rockne personally. That monster was built under Rockne, and Leahy learned under the system, benefited from the wave that was going on. I'm not poo-pooing him, but I think that was just one of the difference makers for me. And the fact that, yes, it was a smaller sample size.
Now, if he had come in right after Rockne, I might agree with you, but there was 10 years separation between Rockne's career ending and Leahy's beginning. So it wasn't like it was snowballing into it. I understand what you're saying, but again, it's hard to be the guy who follows the guy. And he was able to build upon it and then pass it on, leaving it better than he found it, which was kind of hard to do at Notre Dame.
Yeah. And I know Notre Dame did go into a bit of a depression after Rockne, but it wasn't that the wheels fell off either. And it wasn't that they lost their luster or their name. But yeah, point well taken. My number eight is from the earlier years of a nationally recognized program. And that is Charles Bud Wilkinson, the first power coach of Oklahoma, who has been a power for most of the years since. He's really the guy that, to me, built that program, put them on the national map, and made people afraid to play Oklahoma. They were big, they were strong, they were fast. They played with that Southwestern grit and attitude. Once again, not the largest sample size, but big enough. 145 wins, 29 losses, four ties for an 826 percentage. And dominated the Big Eight, 13 consecutive Big Eight titles, 31 game unbeaten streak, 47 game unbeaten streak a few years later. And he was kind of the man, and he was beloved in that state for what he did. And football is king, and he was the king of that football team. In retirement, he ran for U.S. Senate. He lost, but then became a broadcaster for ABC Sports and maintained a big popularity there. Knew what he was talking, was considered definitely a dean of the coaches, one of those guys that other coaches would call and ask for advice. He was a coach's mentor and a great leader of a football team. That's mine, Bud Wilkinson.
I will be talking about Coach Wilkinson a little bit later on in the show. I mean, I agree with everything you're saying. I think there's more to that career, so I placed him a little bit higher, but we'll talk about him in a little bit.
Oh, you think you're better than me?
I think he's better than... Eight.
We shall see. We shall see. So now that we're done with eight, that moves us on to seven. And
number seven.
Number seven is the complete antithesis of my Frank Leahy choice at eight. Frank Leahy only coached for about 10 years, compared with John Gagliardi at St. John's, who has more wins than any other college coach in history, 489. He's had well more than 600 decisions, going 489, 138, and 11. It's a 775 winning percentage. The one kind of fun factoid I love about Gagliardi, other than the wins and the percentages and the fact that he was at one school for so long, is that his coaching at St. John's began in the Truman administration and ended during the Obama administration. I mean, you want to talk about coaching longevity and enjoying success? That's a long, long time. Four NAIA titles, two Division III titles. Was he the most successful in terms of titles or winning percentages or bowls or any of that? No. But when you talk about a coach, much like Larry Karras, you'd brought up earlier, he enjoyed success at the level he was in, graduated a lot of students, great winning percentage, stayed with it. He was a coach's coach. And you know, if we're talking about best coaches and you're talking about a guy who has almost 500 wins in the college ranks, he's got to go on the list. And for me, he goes on the list at number seven.
Yeah, he's done that all. But I'm sorry, Larry Karras was his daddy.
Oh, we're going there now. OK, bring it.
No.
Who's your lame number seven?
My lame number seven is a guy that you might want in a bar fight with you. Just kidding. It's Woody Hayes of Ohio State.
I'm taking off my headset and throwing it down now.
Where I normally have problems with some acts of bad personal behavior, and they can keep people from their list. Like Joe Paterno is not on my list for a lot of those transgressions. Yeah. But this guy,
let's not touch the third rail.
Yeah, I gave this a pass. Woody got a little cantankerous there at the end, punching the Clemson player during the Gator Bowl in 1978 was not cool. If the guy didn't have his helmet on, then I probably would have had even more problem with it. He had a tantrum against the ref, Jerry Mark Bright, who's one of the better refs of his era, during the 1971 Michigan game, where Woody just threw a tantrum and was kicking yardage markers and throwing flags down and all sorts of things. So let's not remember those parts of Woody, even though it's tough not to remember them. Let's remember the 28 years at Ohio State, the 238 wins with 72 losses, 10 ties, for a 744 winning percentage altogether, but he had a 761 winning percentage at Ohio State alone. Five national championships, spread out over three different decades, 13 Big Ten titles. He coached during the 10-year war with Michigan and Bo Schembechler, who used to be a player and coach for Woody. That right there, the 10-year war, is really what made the Ohio State-Michigan rivalry, when both teams are clicking, to me, the best rivalry in all of football, college football. He also taught physical ed at the school. That was one of those days, like high school coaches, he got sucked in having to teach at Ohio State also. Taught English class, vocab class. The famous basketball coach, Bobby Knight of Indiana, was a student of Woody's in his classes. He also coached the only two-time Heisman Trophy winner, Archie Griffin. He called himself Notre Dame's best recruiter because it was Woody's practice that if he couldn't get a recruit, he wanted to make dang sure that Michigan didn't get that recruit. And so he talked badly about Michigan and upsell Notre Dame and send the recruits to Notre Dame, who he didn't have to play every year. So he was a character, but he was a hell of a coach. And he was the big architect of the modern day Ohio State Buckeyes. So Woody Hayes, my number seven.
Woody did win five national championships, but I one of the things doing the research and just confirmed what I knew is Woody pretty much relied on one kind of offense, a bruising running game. If it worked, they were great. If it didn't, they weren't so good. So that tells me that he couldn't do what good coaches should do. And that is you cook with the ingredients in front of you. Don't try and make spaghetti out of a steak. You know, you gotta create what's best for what you have in front of you. And so that's that kind of pull. He didn't make my list. He just bubbled under. And again, that kind of cantankerous thing, I don't know. But you do also bring up a point too. I was, you know, that he was not only a football coach, but he coached other sports. And that was very true. I was just looking back at like Amos Alonzo Stagg, who coached basketball, baseball, and track. You know, Pop Warner also coached baseball. So back in those early years, you did have coaches who had to, you know, do everything. So, you know, kudos for Woody for that. He did have a great record at Ohio State, just didn't make my list.
Yeah, and I understand what you're saying about the running game, but you know what? That's what Big Ten football was. They weren't the innovators of passing. That was left to Notre Dame and the West Coast teams at first, and then the others in the nation followed suit. So, but yeah, understood.
And to his credit, he made it work.
Yeah, to the tune of a lot of success. Absolutely. Let's move on. Yeah. Who is your number six?
Number six.
My number six is a name that is synonymous with college football. Everybody knows this name. If you're a college football fan, you obviously know it. If you're a casual sports fan, you probably know it. If you're a fan of the movie Airplane, you probably know it. My number six is famed Notre Dame coach Newt Rockne. 105, 12, and 5 in his career. He is the guy that built Notre Dame into the brand that it is today. As I mentioned earlier, he was the first one to look at doing a national schedule as opposed to a regional schedule, ushering in what college football has become over the last 50 years, a national sport as opposed to a regional sport. He was the first one to look at coaching as more than X's and O's. Yes, he coached, but he was the one that did come up with these ideas on how to market Notre Dame, how to bring it to the masses, and how to increase the popularity of not only the university, but the sport as well. And he was a hell of a coach. 11 of 13 seasons, the Irish were either undefeated or had one loss. He has the highest winning percentage of any coach with 100 wins or more, and that's 836. And again, his name is just synonymous with college football. So Newt Rockne is my number six.
I love Newt. In fact, I love him. I'll talk about him a little later. My number six is another legend from his own school, and that is Tom Osborne of Nebraska. 25 years their head coach from 1973 through 1997, successor to Bob Devaney, who was also kind of a legend in Nebraska. Osborne later became a three-term congressman for the United States and then became the AD for Nebraska, to which I believe he's still serving as the AD. 255 wins, 836 winning percentage, three national championships, 12 Big Eight titles. His 1995 national championship team is considered as one of the best ever. He coached 53 All-Americans, two Heisman Trophy winners, Johnny Rogers and Mike Rozier. He was also a player in the NFL, which a lot of people don't know. He was drafted by the 49ers. He also played for Washington for a while. But back in Nebraska, he originated a lot of legends and standards and traditions there, such as the black shirts of the black shirt defense. He had the trademark I formation option offense. The number one 12-0 1983 team played in the Orange Bowl versus number five Miami. And this is a good Tom Osborne thing. This shows you kind of competitor and gentleman and classy guy he was. Nebraska was trailing most of the game. They scored a late TD to pull within 1 point, 31-30 toward the end of the game. And instead of going for the extra point, which would have guaranteed him the national title, because it just would have been a tie, not a loss, he opted to go for two to win it the right way, to win it without question. And unfortunately, as things happened to Tom Osborne in Nebraska, the pass failed and they ended up losing, giving Miami their first national championship ever. But the fact that he played it that way, I respect, because that's just the way he was. Classy guy, guy of integrity, the godfather of Nebraska football. And I hope that they can return to those glory years sometime soon, even though it's going to be a long, hard road. But Tom Osborne.
Tom Osborne absolutely belongs on this list, possibly even the Mount Rushmore of college coaches. Again, kind of like Leahy, one school, stellar record over a good chunk of time. And I'm actually going to talk about him a little bit later on, because you have him ranked too low. So we'll talk about Tom a little bit later on.
Oh, I think he's just right, personally. So who are you going to talk about now, Mr. I've got the number five?
I'm going to talk about my number five.
Number five.
And my number five coach is a legend in the coaching annals of college football. He's arguably the greatest coach in FCS history. But what makes him a coach that belongs on this list is not only just the coaching, it's not only the on-the-field stuff, it's the off-the-field stuff as well. My coach is Eddie Robinson, the longtime coach at Grambling University. 693 winning percentage, great, great number. 9 Black College Championships, 17 Southwest titles. Third most victories of any college coach with 408. But he coached during a very difficult era. He coached in the South in the middle part of the century. Black athletes were not allowed to go to Southern college programs. So they came to play for Eddie Robinson at Grambling, and he built a powerhouse. And he not only put those winning ways on the field, but he's the guy that set an example of what hard work was all about. He was a jack of all trades at the school. He taped ankles. He conducted the band. He lined the field. He did everything to make that program successful for his student athletes. So to have that kind of commitment, that kind of dedication, and then that kind of winning percentage, and turn out the players that he did for such a long period of time in a very difficult environment, that's what makes Eddie Robinson my number five.
If I had to vote for best person as a coach and everything, Eddie Robinson's my number one for all the reasons you just said, I think hands down. But for my list, he was probably 11 or 12. And it's,
that's because you put Woody Hayes on your list.
Yes. But oh, Woody,
that's okay. Put the coach that slugs the Clemson player on the list. Let's leave the patron saint of college football off for cranky Woody Hayes.
Well, I don't know if I call him the patron saint of college football, but he was an excellent person. Deserved, like I said, everything you said about him, but good choice on your part. My number five is not him. He's a guy that a lot of people don't know about, really. And he was the kind of the founding father of Michigan football. And it's not Bo Schembechler. It's Fielding Yost. 808 winning percentage, 198 wins, 35 losses, 12 ties. At Michigan by himself, he had 165 wins, 29 losses, 10 ties for an 833 percentage. 6 national championships. Had 4 in a row from 01 through 04. 10 Big Ten titles. There was one season where he had 550 points and his opponents had 0. I think we talked about this in last week. Then he had a record of, or he had a point scored of 2,281 points versus 42 points for his opponents over 4 consecutive years. That's domination. The boys at Michigan were doing something right under Fielding Yost. His teams were known as a point-a-minute teams. They were 55-1-1. He was the innovator of the hurry up offense, and so much so because he was always telling everybody to hurry during practice and hurry in everything they do. He became known as Hurry Up Yost. He beat Stanford 49-0 in the 1902 Rose Bowl, which was the first college bowl game ever. He had a bitter feud with Newt Rockne. Maybe not the guy you want to have a bitter feud with, and kind of might have been responsible for the Big Ten's blackballing of Notre Dame and refusing to play them. So he was a competitive guy, that's for sure. Turned on the Jets, stepped on the gas, and never let up. And he also coached at Kansas, Stanford, Nebraska, San Jose State. He got around. Fielding Yost in Michigan, my number five.
And yet another altar boy goes on Steve's list.
What, because he didn't like Newt Rockne?
No, he blackballed Notre Dame from joining the conference. He was absolutely hypocritical. He was critical about the league and how they had certain rules, and then turned around and blackballed Notre Dame. I'm not saying he's a bad guy. I'm just saying, you know, maybe he had a little extra something in his coffee.
And Senator, we have no proof that he was totally responsible. Thank you.
So what we're hearing is Steve's list is the win at all costs list.
Oh no, because then I'd have some other guys like John Gagliardi on my list.
Well, that winning at all that cost means, okay, John, you have to stay at this university for 60 years.
Well, I think we will come to find that most of these coaches have that annoying characteristic that the win at all costs thing is a big part of their mantra. And in our next four on both of our lists, I think we'll see good examples of that.
Possibly.
So let's get there. We are at Mount Rushmore. Who is your number four?
Number four.
My number four is somebody you talked about a little bit earlier, and that is Bud Wilkinson, the coach at Oklahoma. 826 winning percentage, 145 wins versus 29 losses. At one point, they won 47 straight games, eclipsing Leahy's 46-game winning streak. 14 conference titles, 3 national championships, 6-8 in bowl games, invented the no-huddle offense. But here's what I think is a remarkable stat. Bud Wilkinson's teams were undefeated in conference play from 1947 to 1958. I mean, that's just an incredible streak to be undefeated in conference play, win the conference outright the whole time. I just think that he was the guy that really put Oklahoma on the map even further. I mean, Oklahoma was always a successful program, but very much, you know, recruiting anywhere in the Midwest is difficult. You usually have to use homegrown guys, and he was able to do it. I just think that he represented Oklahoma very well. He is certainly one of the most celebrated college coaches of all time, and he is my number four.
Well, you know, I like him. I'm just going to go straight to my number four, which is one of the newer breed of coaches, and that is Urban Meyer. Started Bowling Green, then went to University of Utah, University of Florida, and Ohio State. And he just kept getting better and better and better as he went. Even though he had 2 national championships at Florida and only 1 at Ohio State, I personally think the Ohio State teams, man for man, year for year, were more consistent and a little more of a threat to make the big bowl games or the final playoff games. Coach for 17 years, and I suspect that we will see him again sometime in the future. He's serving as an analyst on Fox right now, doing a nice job with Matt Leinart and Reggie Bush and Brady Quinn and the gang. During his 17 years, he had 187 wins, only 32 losses for an 854 winning percentage, the 3 national titles I mentioned. He also has 3 Big Ten titles, 2 SEC titles, 2 Mountain West titles. One of 3 coaches to win the national championship on 2 different universities, along with Nick Saban and Pop Warner. And he spent 2 years as a minor league shortstop in baseball for the Atlanta Braves, which I didn't know until I started researching this. I thought that was interesting. Everywhere he goes, he turns the program into a contender. And to me, that is a mark of a good coach. Different climate, different school, different recruiting, different personnel, and he makes it into his own and then bends it toward his will with the recruiting. He's a master of the spread offense, and I think, like I said, we will see more of him, and it wouldn't surprise me if he doesn't add another national title somewhere down the line. Urban Meyer, my number four.
Great choice. He was one that really bubbled under for me. I just Yeah, we get back to that old question of, okay, I've got my list. I want to put Urban on it. Who do I take off? Mm-hmm. And it was just hard to try and find that fit. But I can absolutely see how you'd have them as high as you do. You know, a lot of these coaches, you know, you could place any of them from 10 to 1, and you could make an argument for it as well. But I also agree with you, too. I think he's not done coaching, and it'll be interesting to see if he goes to the NFL or stays in college.
Please, USC. Please, USC. Please, USC.
He can go to South Carolina all you want.
They are not USC. Let's move on. Who is the funny man's number three?
Number three.
The funny man's number three is somebody you already talked about. Tom Osborne, 836 winning percentage, 25 seasons. Winning no fewer than 9 games each season. Every team he coached ended up in the top 25. 18 of those seasons, they were in the top 10. 53 All-Americans, which meant he had more than 2 per season. 1 Heisman winner, 3 national championships. He was very much at the forefront of challenging the norms on strength and conditioning and nutrition for his programs, and integrated that. So he was very much at the forefront. He came to a program that had history, ton of geographical challenges. And to me, he arguably produced the best 25-year stretch in college football. So Tom Osborne, somebody you talked about a little bit earlier, he is my number three.
Yeah. For those of you who aren't nearly as advanced in age as Kirk and I are, it was quite something to watch the Nebraska, Oklahoma, Texas rivalries that were going on back there when Barry Switzer was with Oklahoma, Darryl Royal was with Texas, Hayden Fry at Iowa. There was some really good stuff going on in football in the Midwest back then. My number three is somebody that you have talked about before, and that is who we, I think, agree is kind of the face of college football coaching, or at least one of the main faces, and that is Newt Rockne of Notre Dame. You mentioned the 13 years, you mentioned his winning percentage and the games won. It's back in that era, so there's not a huge amount of games played. There were some limitations for travel and everything, but he definitely did the most with what he had to deal with. He was educated as a chemist and pharmacist, which I found interesting, and just decided that wasn't the career for him and made the switch and became one of the best ever. Pretty impressive. He popularized the forward pass, a big part of the modern game. Any guy who gets immortalized in his own film, Newt Rockne All-American, his story, I think brings a lot of credence to how good you are. If you haven't seen that movie, do see it. It's where the famous George Gipp speech happens and everything. Fun movie to watch. In the College Football Hall of Fame, and they recognize him as, without question, America football's most renowned coach. He died in a plane crash in 1931. So his career might have gone longer. We just don't know. President Herbert Hoover called that a national loss for the nation, that we lost that icon of football and of Notre Dame. That's my number three, Newt Rockne.
Excellent choice. And again, you know, he is the name brand of college football coaches. As we talked about, he is the face. He's that name that everybody knows.
Yeah.
So it's a good choice at number three.
So let's move into the big time. Who is your runner up? Who is number two on Kirk's list?
Number two.
All right. Let's see if we're going to match up. I have a feeling our next two names are going to be the same two names. It just depends on which order that they are in.
If they aren't, I worry about us.
My number two, won 323 games at the University of Alabama, 6 national championships. And that is Coach Bear Bryant.
Me too.
Yeah. All right. So we are on the same page. Again, very much like Newt Rockne, this is a guy who's synonymous with college football coaches.
Yeah. I think if Newt's not the face of college football, that Bear is. Definitely.
I mean, the fact that the houndstooth hat is still like required wearing by fans at Alabama games is still just... makes me laugh. And talk about rabid fans. I mean, he built a fan base that obviously somebody else that we'll talk about in a minute, I have a feeling, has kept going. But, you know, Alabama football, as long as we've been alive, which is almost 60 years, has been a thing. And it all started with Bear Bryant.
Yeah. We talked a little bit on the last show about Alabama and their coaches. We also mentioned Gene Stallings as being, you know, quite an amazing coach for college. And so you look at Alabama's sustained success over the years, and you got to ask yourself, what happened to those few little down periods that they had? It's like, how does that happen? That's just the Crimson Tidal wave that just seems to keep on going. But it's not because it's a given. It's because they've had two of the most amazing coaches ever. And Bear Bryant is one of that. 13 SEC titles, 12-time SEC Coach of the Year. Back when he was at Texas A&M, he had an undefeated season in 1956. The guy knew how to coach, no doubt.
And he was one, you know, going back to something I'd said earlier, he used the players that he had to their best ability. He won running the ball. He run throwing the ball. He learned how to platoon. I mean, he changed along with the game, changed along with his players. And I think that's what helped contribute to the success.
Yeah. And the change, because I told the John McKay story about Bear Bryant wanting to bring integration to a school. Let's not pretend that we don't know. He was also a main instigator of keeping the all white teams at the beginning, but then he had the wherewithal to see what was being said and see what some of the people wanted and just knew that it made logical sense. How can you not? And so he came to that point, made the choice and the change, and then decided to go into the world of integration, which was the right move. And so where I can blame him before, I have to give him credit for making that change.
Yeah. You know, we all learn. And that's what he demonstrated there. He learned. He grew. He came to the right decision, and he acted upon it, which is a lot more than you can say about a lot of folks. So, yes, where it can be, you can ding him earlier. You got to give him credit later on in the game.
That's right. Well, that was both of our number two.
So, shall we stay in the state of Alabama?
Well, let's recap. Recap our list first, and then we can go back to Alabama. So, let's just take a little side trip to Mississippi or someplace like that for a moment, and say my list to this point included at number 10, John McKay, followed at number 9 by the Mountain Union Division III coach Larry Karras. Number 8 was Charles Bud Wilkinson, the dean of Oklahoma football. Woody Hayes at number 7, Tom Osborne from Nebraska at number 6, Michigan's Fielding Yost at number 5, Urban Meyer at number 4, Newt Rockne at number 3, and Paul Bear Bryant at number 2. Kirk, who was on your list from 10 to 2?
Well, it's interesting. Usually we have matched somewhere before here. The fact that we've had different names all along the way and even staggered a little bit is kind of fun. Mm-hmm. Number 10, Amos Alonzo Stagg. Number 9, Pop Warner. 8, Frank Leahy from Notre Dame. John Gagliardi from St. John's at number 7. Newt Rockne, who you mentioned also, number 6. Eddie Robinson from Grambling at 5. Bud Wilkinson, 4. Tom Osborne at 3. Bear Bryant at number 2.
Which brings us to
number 1.
And at number 1, I have got...
We have got,
okay... Nick Saban, current head coach at the University of Alabama, an 877 winning percentage at Alabama over 14 seasons, with this week's win, 7 total national championships, 6 at Alabama, in only half the time that it took Bear Bryant to do the same thing, a little bit more than half the time. And he's also taken them to 8 national championship games, Alabama to 8 national championship games.
That's right.
I would argue that he's the most dominant coach of this era.
Yeah, and he's not showing any sign of slowing down. So I think he's, well, we already have him at number 1, but he just might make it no question of being the best coach of all time pretty soon.
And I mean, look what he did this year, undefeated in 2020. And the only head coach to win national championships at 2 different FBC schools, at LSU and at Alabama.
That's right. And even though his Michigan State experience was a little lower down as far as his win percentage, he still is having success at Michigan State. So it's not like that was a travesty. Nick Saban, definitely known for being on point and very focused and serious and driven and maybe even a little crotchety sometimes and short with the media. But the results speak for themselves. He does have a sense of humor, though. He is truly sincerely liked, if not loved, by his players. And it's not just for the success that he brings them. I think he teaches them a lot about life, how to conduct themselves, whatever. A little story came out the other day at New York. They were at the Heisman Trophy ceremony because both Devonta Smith and Mac Jones were in the final four for the Heisman Trophy. And Saban walked by and both guys are sitting near the trophy. So he just stopped and he looked at him and said, "Well, are you two going to fight over that thing? If so, let's get it on and get it over with." So, which made them laugh, broke the tension. I think he does have a sense of humor that doesn't get shown a lot. And I think a lot of that's by his own choice. He kind of saves it for his team and his friends and whatnot. I don't think there's too much more you can say. His only real slam that you can have on him, if it's a slam, is his bowl record isn't like, you know, 25-1. He has lost some bowl games, but still he's got a pretty big winning percentage in those too. So 13 Coach of the Year awards.
And as we talked about last week, when you get back to the bowl records, as you're talking about, you know, it's understandable where a team might not have a sparkling bowl record because you do get matched up against other really good teams. And what I love about bowl games, especially back in the early days when you'd have the, you know, the Pac-10, you know, Big Ten matchup at the Rose Bowl, is you're talking schools that haven't played each other, that are, you know, don't have common foes. So you really can't gauge, you know, what their abilities are against each other. Apples to apples, it's a little more apples to oranges. So you do get the surprises where a team that may be the underdog comes in and has a big win just because, again, you haven't seen this school against common competition and know exactly what they're capable of. So, you know, I can't fault bowl records too much.
No, he's clear cut number one right now. So that's our list. We're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we will have David Hale to hear his take on the all-time greatest college coaches. So we'll see you soon.
Hello. Wait, what? You haven't heard the new podcast, Mojo Girl Madness? Good news. Season 1 is now available for binging. Mojo Girl Madness is a mad pod with interviews, rants, and stories about sex, relationships, family, divorce, politics, showbiz, and mostly your mojo. Find Mojo Girl Madness wherever you get your pods or at mojogirlmadness.com. And now, back to the main event. Love you madly.
Okay, we're back for our second half, which means it's time for
the guest list.
The guest list, and returning is our first returning guest ever, and that is David Hale, who's with us when we did best football programs or college football programs. And he's a ESPN college football writer. He's been writing about football since 2005. He's covered University of Georgia. He graduated from Syracuse. He's covered the 2013, 16, and 18 national champ teams. And as we mentioned before, he personally is very, very good friends with Nick Saban. Okay, well, at least he was in an elevator with Nick Saban.
Nodding acquaintance.
There's a good Simpsons quote, which is more of a well wisher, and that I wish you no specific harm. So that's I feel like that's where Nick Saban is with.
Exactly. So we're on best all time coaches, and as we kind of talk, there's a little bit of a problem here when you're talking about best all-time teams, best all-time coaches, is the parameters of what you put into formulating this list. And because there are so many great coaches from way back before most of our viewers, including myself, were alive, you know, and could see them in person, such as the Newt Rockneys, Amos Alonzo, Staggs, you know, those people of the world. And then, of course, we are living the Nick Saban era, and we were watching Urban Meyer not too long ago, and you know, some of these great coaches. How do you think one should go about talking about great coaches, and does the time period make a big difference?
So I gave this a good bit of thought, and there were a few things that kind of came into mind as I started kind of considering all of this. The time period certainly, I think, has to, because the game has evolved so much. So there was a time when there was no scholarship limits. And if you were Nebraska and you wanted to have 130 guys on scholarship, you could do that. That is not any longer the case. There was a time, certainly, when college football coaches were not under the amount of pressure to win that they are now. They are well compensated for that pressure, but I mean, we've seen plenty of coaches that get the axe after just a year and a half, 2 years, less than that in some cases. I think the media attention that is on coaches these days is markedly different. I mean, when players get in trouble these days, as 18 to 22 year olds are wont to do from time to time on a college campus, a lot of that comes back on the coach, and they've got to figure all that out. And the amount of attention and focus, you know, there's not much that gets slid under the radar these days. And then just the amount of competition. I mean, look, Texas is going to spend close to $200 million on its football program over the course of a year. Like, and they just fired Tom Herman, who just won a bowl game and had a winning record there. I mean, the demands on coaching are huge. And it's, you know, I think when you ask the average college football fan, what's central casting, give me your college football coach, what comes to mind? They're going to talk about Bear Bryant. They're going to talk about Junction Boys. They're going to, that hard nose, drive them till they pass out, no water on the sidelines. We're going to be tough and we're going to go get them. And that ain't coaching anymore either. You're in some ways your dad, your psychologist, your nutritionist. You have the hats that you have to wear as a head coach these days is immense. There's a lot of them. And that's not to take anything away from what a lot of great coaches in the past have done, because coaching is coaching. And I think coaches are always a little bit of a father figure. And you can go back and talk to the players, even that have played for some bad coaches, who said, you know, that guy changed my life. And so I don't want to diminish what others have done, but I think the job that guys have today is just, you know, 10 times harder than what it might have been. Even the kind of previous generation of great coaches, of the Paternos and the Bowdens and like, and maybe you look at somebody like Urban Meyer, who has quite literally pushed himself to the hospital by stressing so much over the job of coaching. So, to me, I'm giving some credit to the folks that are around today, but I also think the other things that you've got to look at is how many players have you developed? That's at the end of the day, part of the job is winning, but part of the job is developing those guys. You're going to college as a football player, the same way you're kind of going to college as for med school or to become a writer or whatever. Your job is to learn how to do it as a professional. So college football coaches should be developing players so that they can become professionals. And then they're also training other coaches. So you look at a coaching tree for a coach. How many of their assistants went on to do something else and have success? Those things matter. Are you an institutional success? A guy like Bobby Bowden, who won at Florida State and kind of built that program? Are you a guy who's had success kind of inheriting it from somebody else and carrying that success on? Jimmy Johnson is a guy who came to mind at Miami, who inherited a pretty good program, made it better, and then left it for another person who could do a lot of good work with it, in Dennis Erickson. Or are you a guy who's done it in multiple places? Again, Urban Meyer won big at Bowling Green, at Utah, at Florida, at Ohio State. And there are probably 100 other programs that would line up to hire him tomorrow, including ones in the NFL. So I think a lot goes into that. And then it's hard to kind of, you know, again, we talk about what is the pressure on coaches and the responsibilities that they have. I mean, when you've got some pretty bad things on your resume, as Joe Paterno, for example, does, like, where does that fit into your overall accounting of things? Because at the end of the day, that's part of their job, too.
You know, these are all great points that I honestly didn't think in depth on, but you're right. Somebody like a Pappy Waldorf or, you know, Heisman or any of these older coaches, they did not have the media scrutiny. They did not have to recruit the way that today's coaches have to. It almost feels like today's coaches are CEOs of large companies and really have... Yeah. There's not so much coaching involved as in putting the right people in the right place to do a lot of that for the program. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah. And so one of the coaches that I'm probably closest with in terms of just I've spent a lot of time around them is Dabo Swinney at Clemson. And he's such a fascinating example because he was never a head coach or even a coordinator before he got the job at Clemson. His predecessor, Tommy Bowden, resigned/was going to get fired, and he was named the interim coach in 2008 after being the wide receivers coach. Everyone laughed at the decision. Dabo, if you get to know him, is a little bit of a kind of a hokey, all shucks, dad joke type of guy. So I don't know that he was, without the resume, he didn't do much to engender much confidence from folks around the world. But what Dabo's good at are, I think, the things that a CEO is good at. He's an excellent motivator. He's an excellent salesman. He's a very insightful, long-term thinker. He's very detail-oriented. He is absolutely a people person, more than maybe almost anyone I've ever met. He has a way of saying, I've got this vision for this thing, and I can't make it happen without you. You're going to be an important part of this vision, and don't you want to make this vision come true? And boy, it's so easy to get behind that when he explains it to you that way. He was a walk-on at Alabama, grew up in Alabama, dirt poor, was a walk-on at Alabama, earned a scholarship, got a job as a GA at Bama, coached under Gene Stallings at Alabama. And then the coaching staff after Stallings, they all got fired. So Dabo was out of a job. He went and sold commercial real estate for a couple of years. And I've talked to his boss at that company who said Dabo would have been a millionaire selling commercial real estate. He was so good at it. And that kind of just shows you that the job of being a college football coach today, yes, of course you've got to know the X's and O's. You've got to know football inside and out. But the job, a lot of the qualities that make you successful at it, it's the same stuff that would make you a good CEO at Microsoft or Google or Ford or selling commercial real estate.
Yeah. Good point. It's weird about the old versus new too. There are so many more requirements and pressures put on the new guys that the old guys didn't have to face. But then some of the things that the old guys did have to face was travel. When you look at travel, granted, they had less games, but there was no, you know, they weren't doing air travel. There wasn't all these wonderful hotels that were really set up for incoming teams and whatever. So that was a whole different thing. And I think those coaches had some extra work involved when their team went on the road, especially to a hostile environment or whatever, a whole different ball game there. They also had less equipment, worse training rooms, you know, a lot of that stuff too, but it came down to brass tacks. So maybe they might have been better at all facets of the game than some of the new coaches, especially if those guys didn't come up through the ranks and have other positions before they became head coaches. I don't know. It's tough to gear. Do you lean more toward the modern coach when forming a list like this?
I tend to, I think, just because I think some of the challenges these days are so immense. On the other hand, you know, there's a foundation of what college football is that was built by coaches a long time ago. I mean, you know, the guys who sort of invented and perfected the Veer offense, then seeing that evolve and somebody has to come in and say, no, we're going to do, you know, I won't spoil my list, but like, where do you put Steve Spurrier, who really reinvented what playing in space and the passing game was supposed to be? And then you look at a guy like Mike Leach, who, I mean, utterly transformed college football by going into a run and shoot style air raid offense. And the number of coach, I mean, look, the NFL now, 25 years after Mike Leach first started doing this, is trying to hire the assistants who came up under Leach learning this system. So when you start talking about, especially I think the X's and O's sides of things, the guys who really were innovative over the years, it's hard to discount that from, you know, just the job of being a head coach. I mean, you can be a head coach and steal everybody else and be really good at stealing everybody else's ideas. You know, that's there's nothing wrong with that. That's good at that's knowing who's doing things well and figuring out how to do it yourself. But to be the type of innovator who genuinely comes up with something utterly original in a sport that is thought so deeply about as football is, I think speaks volumes. And certainly over the 150 years of college football, there's been a lot of coaches who have come along and said, everybody does it this way. I'm going to try doing it this way and change the game forever.
Yeah, really good point. I was also amazed by, there were a couple coaches that started down in the lower divisions and came up. Jim Tressel being a very good example of somebody who's hugely successful at both the lower divisions and up in the major sports. And we don't see a lot of those. We will see guys who dominate down in the lower divisions or guys like Eddie Robinson at Grambling State, so forth. But then Tressel's one of those few guys that was dominant down below and when he arrived at Ohio State.
Yeah, Chris Kleeman is a guy at Kansas State right now who was hired from North Dakota State. And a lot of people kind of shrugged their heads and didn't like the hire when they made it because, bring up a guy from the FCS level. I don't think that's good because just you don't see it that much anymore. But he's done a nice job at K-State. And, boy, what they built it at North Dakota State, I mean, that program has been at the FCS level. There's nothing like it. They're dominated. And so, yeah, I mean, it's interesting too. And I've talked about this a lot with my colleagues is like, we see coaches hired and fired all the time. Does anybody really know what makes a good coach? Because we're going to sit here and talk about ranking our top 10, but the people who are paid a whole lot of money to hire someone and pay them a whole lot of money to be their head coach, I don't think they really know either.
And there's a lot of evidence for that.
Well, there's so many variables that go into this, you know, as well. If you're at a school that's got higher academic requirements than ones that that don't have those higher academic requirements, do you have money at the school? Do you not have money at the school? I think there's just so many variables, and that's why I always find it interesting that college coaches that go to the NFL, because it is really kind of apples and oranges. Yes, it's still football, but I think the demands, like we just talked about, whether you're the father confessor, whether you're the motivator or what have you, that may not play as well in the NFL when the players really have more power than in college, although college players are beginning to realize that they have some of that as well, as witness what happened in the Pac-12.
This year. I mean, it's a really good example. Now, and even that, I think it's a little bit of, it's even hard to gauge because Pete Carroll failed in New England. Went to USC. I'm not sure people even loved that hire when it was made. Steve, you can probably speak to that a little bit. Yeah. Who was an immensely successful coach at USC, gets hired by the Seahawks, and is immensely successful there. And if you put him back in New England tomorrow, I'm still not sure that he would be successful in New England because it was such a unique dynamic there. So you're right. I mean, fit is a big part of this in its own right. And I always, when I talk to people about, hey, what, who should our school hire? What makes a good head coach? I always say step one, know thyself, you know, as the school doing the hiring, what are your strengths and what are your weaknesses? Where can you find an advantage over your competition? And then look for a coach who can cover up some of those weaknesses and really expand and build a foundation around your strengths. And as a coach, again, know the same things, man. Is this going to be a bad fit for me? What's the situation there? Am I going to work with these people well? Because so much of that has to fit together. The puzzle for success is not just good coach, good players. There's a bunch of other pieces that have to go in that too. And if you don't kind of know where you fit within that puzzle, it's real hard to make it work.
Is it better for a coach to have a vision and lead people to it? Or is it better for a coach to look to see what he has and see what they can make out of what they
have?
It's
sort of a good macro-micro argument, because I think in the macro sense, you better have a vision. You better have a vision that you can sell. And particularly in college, where recruiting is such a critical part of what goes on, you got to have a picture that you can paint when you sit down in that living room for that kid and tell him, we want you to come play for us. So vision is super important. And to try and get everybody on the same page and rowing in the same direction is super important. But I've always said, I think the worst coaches are the ones who say, this is the way that I do it. And I don't care whether or not you fit this, you're going to do it this way. I remember when Jim Mora Jr. was coaching the Falcons when he had Michael Vick, and his dad, who was a longtime NFL coach, had given an interview saying that his son was just so annoyed with Michael Vick. It was such a problem to have to deal with Michael Vick because Michael Vick just didn't fit what Mora wanted to do. I'm like, you've got Michael Vick. You change what you want to do to fit Michael Vick. And that's a little bit of sort of what I think. Like, man, if you've got a guy with tremendous talent and you're not utilizing that talent, that's on you as a coach, man. You messed up somewhere if you can't get the most out of Michael Vick.
Absolutely. Now you look at Chip Kelly at UCLA, who came in and didn't like the personnel that he had. He ran a lot of guys out of that program, and he suffered badly for 2 years. this year they weren't great, but you could see where the Chip Kelly program was starting to take effect and the game plan was starting to have, you know, pay off some dividends. And my guess is they'll be even better next year. And then the year after that, watch out. They could be highly exciting and highly, highly good.
No, I'm with you on that. And I think it's one of the most interesting things. I mean, you see a lot of coaches that are kind of taking over. I think there's sort of a tiered process of making a program successful. It's you're turning a bad program into a good one, or are you taking a good one into a pretty good one, or are you taking a pretty good one into a great one? That last step's the hardest to make. And that's where you see, you know, schools like Michigan and Texas and Auburn cycling through coaches that are, they're just getting guys that are inheriting 9-win programs and saying, figure out a way to get us to win 11 or 12 games. That extra 2 or 3 games is really, really hard. And it's a different job than taking over a 3-win program and trying to make them relevant again. And so I think sometimes when you're coming in, you're trying to maximize what you've inherited to try and win 6 or 7 games, while trying to build what you, your vision down the road, which is to get you to 9, 10, 11, 12 games. But a lot of times when you're a coach who comes into these programs that they've already got their vision, and that's, I want to win a national championship next year. Boy, it's real tough to sell everybody on your own vision.
Yeah. And like you talked about, the ADs, whether they know what they're hiring in the first place or who they're looking for, you know, and how much support they're going to give the coach after they do make the hire. You were mentioning Pete Carroll, and you're exactly right. He was at least the 4th or 5th guy that Mike Garrett looked at. And Mike Garrett's assistant, AD, was the one who brought Pete to the table and said, you should look at him. And he was a great fit. But, you know, he had a 6-6 year, and then everything else was magic after that. So I'd love to give Mike Garrett a lot of credit, but I just can't. It was just one of those things.
But that's for another podcast. Yeah.
A little serendipitous hires every now and again. There was a lot of people more than happy to run Dabo out of town the first second that they had an opportunity. Sometimes it works out. Frank Beamer at Virginia Tech had a losing record, I think, after his first 5 seasons. Turned out okay for them.
Yeah. Yeah. And then just see what the fan base of Michigan's reaction is once Harbaugh signs his extension. It's going to be interesting.
I'm always having covered sports and dealing with college football fans, they all want their coaches fired. And the first question I always ask is, all right, who you going to get? Who's replacing them? Because it's nobody's ever doing a good enough job. But the list of people who are going to do better is awfully short, too.
Yeah. And I think that could translate to the pros of almost any sport also. Like, fire your manager. But who's coming in? Who's going to be better?
And speaking of short lists, I think you've got one for us, right?
I do, and I'm gonna stick with this, even though I'm not sure how much I believe it, but I've convinced myself on this list, so we're gonna go with it. Number 10 on my list is Tom Osborne. That great Nebraska team's really set Nebraska up for some success for a while after he left too. Worked as the AD there too, is still incredibly influential at Nebraska. Tom Osborne at number 10. Number 9, I've got Joe Paterno. Number 8, I went with Steve Spurrier, and I say if you can win big at South Carolina and you can win it all at Duke, the stuff you did at Florida was just gravy. So Steve Spurrier is 8 on my list. I have Bobby Bowden at number 7, and I put Bowden ahead of Spurrier just because I think I have more Florida State fans that are friends with me than Florida fans. So see about that. Number 6, I went off the board a little bit, and I went with Larry Karras from Mount Union. And he won 11 national titles there. He's had a ton. Matt Campbell, who is probably one of the hottest names in coaching now, worked for him at Mount Union. I wanted to represent the little guys a little bit, and I don't think there's anybody who does that better than Larry does. So. Number 5, I went with Urban Meyer. Again, I'm leaning a little bit more towards the modern day coaches, and the fact that Urban has done it and done it at a high level at a lot of different places to me speaks really highly to what kind of a coach he is. Number 4, I went with Eddie Robinson, and we could do a whole nother episode just on what makes Eddie Robinson so great, and put together my top 10 list of things that were awesome about Eddie Robinson. Number 3, Newt Rockne, because if they're making movies about you, you're high on the list. Number 2, Bear Bryant, which I think is, you know, if he's not number 2 on everybody's list, he's number 1. But number 1 on my list is unquestionably Nick Saban. I would love to hear somebody make the argument that Nick Saban is not the most successful college football coach in the sports history. What he has done at Alabama is utterly ridiculous. And one of the things, I think the absolute hardest thing to do is not to win, it is to keep winning. And I have had so many conversations with players who are like, you have no idea how much I didn't want to get up at 4 a.m. to go to do another workout after I already had a national championship ring on my finger. Any coach who can get guys to keep doing that, not year after year, day after day after day, man, I am in awe. I don't know how they do it, but for me, Nick Saban, number one, easy.
Well, and it's also with Saban, I think it's a great choice. You know, he's the guy that followed Bear Bryant and Gene Stallings. I mean, he stepped into an environment that is probably one of the most difficult and has the highest expectations of any college football program out there. And to not only meet those expectations, but exceed them. I mean, you know, you never want to be the guy that follows Vin Scully.
Yeah.
You never want to be the guy that follows,
John Wooden.
And he not only did that, he came in and went right after, you know, went right after the program and took it to new heights.
If you went back,
I don't want to be the guy to follow him.
If you went back in a time machine to 2006 and you went around the state of Alabama and just bet people, hey, I bet the next coach that Alabama hires, at some point down the road, you're going to think he's better than Bear Bryant. You'd never have to pay for another drink or another meal in the state of Alabama again, because every single person would have taken that bet from you. But that's where we're at.
Yeah. Well, I think David Shula must have gone thirsty. following, you know, an Alabama tradition or Kentucky or UCLA basketball tradition, that's a thankless job for a coach.
I mean, yeah.
Yikes. So that's an awesome list.
Yeah, again, you don't want to follow the guy. You want to follow the guy who follows the guy.
That's exactly right.
Well, we can't thank you enough again for joining us on a second show and talking a little football, and especially coaching of football, and providing us with your list, which I said is fantastic. It's hard to argue with anybody on that. It's a good one.
Oh, no problem. I'm glad I could do it. I think if I do like three more shows, do I get a commemorative like smoking jacket or Five Timers Club hat or something?
Well, you're already the...
I love that idea.
You're already the first person to have his likeness on the trophy twice. So,
Excellent. Well, it's the little things that get me through my day. I'm more than happy to do it.
Well,
maybe that's our next show, is top 10 ideas for five episode tokens.
I like it. Getting a little meta with the show. I like
now, it. We didn't ask you this last time because we knew you were coming on again, but what's next for David Hale? What's happening in the near future here?
Well, now that college football season is all wrapped up with a nice tidy bow, I hope I get to sleep for a little while and maybe see my family and whatnot. And actually, it would be lovely to do some of this job, not via Zoom in the near future. But now you folks can follow me on Twitter. I'm at a David Hale joint. I can promise you that in the off season, I will still tweet a good bit of football, but you're going to get a whole lot of other really dumb stuff as well, but hopefully entertaining along the way. And then, of course, one of the great things about college football is the season never technically ends, even though the games have stopped being played. So we'll have lots of good content on ESPN.com, and hope you'll come over and read.
Absolutely. No, it's good stuff. I've read your stuff before, and one of the reasons that I'm happy to have you on. And so thanks again, David, and best of luck. Next year, hopefully we'll have fans in the stands and the atmosphere will be back, and it'll be a great season to be a writer and to be a fan.
I hope so. I'm right there with you. Thanks so much for having me, guys.
All right. Thanks. Take care.
It's been a pleasure, man. Thank you for dropping by. Please come back.
Will do. Anytime.
All right.
Well, that was great. And big thanks to David Hale again for being with us two different episodes. He's our first repeat guest, but a good guy to have on. He definitely knows what he's doing. ESPN likes him a lot, and it's nice to have somebody who comes from that point of expertise to talk about things with us. Always appreciate it.
You can see why ESPN likes him a lot. Knowledgeable guy, good conversationalist, had some great takes. Glad we had him on the show. He did great both shows.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, I think that brings us to our next section, which is
The Populist,
the chance where our listeners get their voices and their input heard on the show with their take on the list. We had a good amount of votes again. We had a tie for number 10 with Joe Paterno and Eddie Robinson. Number 9 was also a tie with Jimmy Johnson, somebody we haven't heard yet, but great success at the University of Miami, and Woody Hayes. Number 8 was John McKay. Number 7, Dabo Sweeney. I was kind of wondering when he would show his name, as well as number 6, Bo Schembechler, who was on my honorable mention. I didn't talk about, but Michigan's great coach. Number 5 was a tie between Lou Holtz of Notre Dame and South Carolina and Bobby Bowden of Florida State. Number 4 was Newt Rockne. Number 3 was Nick Saban, both of our number ones. In fact, David's also. Number 2 was Urban Meyer. And number 1 was Bear Bryant. So I guess if Nick Saban's not going to be your number 1, Bear Bryant should be the guy. So good choice by the listeners. I can respect that for sure.
Well, it just goes to show, too, in the research that we did, the list that we just reviewed, there's a lot of great college coaches out there. And it really is how you want to, you know, take the numbers and divide them out and then put them in your order. But you can't go wrong with any of those choices.
Yeah.
And it also proves, too, that if you wear a houndstooth hat, you end up at the top of the list.
Cut to us both next week wearing houndstooth hats. Yeah, but guys like Holtz and Bobby Bowden, you know, you can make arguments for them. Dabo Sweeney with his recent success, for sure. So good job, listeners. Now it brings us to another favorite segment of ours, the A-List, where we talk about somebody who's made a positive impact in the world or is just a positive person and doing good things. Kirk, who is your A-lister this week?
This one is tough and bittersweet. And entirely appropriate as a baseball fan, as a Giants fan. The name Tommy Lasorda has been part of my baseball experience for the last 50 years. And the baseball world and the world in general lost Tommy last week. He was infuriating. He was all things Dodger blue, which was just, you know, as a Giants fan, maybe completely allergic to it, but there's no denying the guy represented baseball. He represented the Dodgers. He represented things that all the good things about baseball, and really brought a lot of fans to the game. And as much as you wanted to hate the guy, you loved to hate the guy. He'll be missed. He'll be missed at Dodger Stadium. He'll be missed in baseball. And I just wanted to say Godspeed to Tommy Lasorda.
You're a good man and classy man. Nice thing to do. Yep. Tommy was a big part of baseball. Definitely an icon of the Dodgers. And his passing will be missed by the world of baseball and all Dodger fans everywhere for sure. My A-lister is a gentleman by the name of Alvin Bamberg of Grand Cane, Louisiana. Alvin was hunting in the woods when he found an old balloon with a note attached. The note was a note for Santa from two twin young girls of the Flores Gonzalez family, 650 miles away in Liberal, Kansas. Bamberg thought this was a sweet note and he wanted to do something about it. So using social media, he was able to track down the family, get a hold of Letitia, the mother, and worked out a way to fulfill the girls' Christmas wishes by contacting other people on social media and friends of his, and they donated items. The girl's mother told the daughters that a special elf named Alvin had found the letter after Santa had dropped it. And soon after, the gifts for the wish list arrived, courtesy of Alvin the elf. Mr. Bamberg had secured the donations, as I mentioned, from a bunch of well-intentioned people. Alvin and the kind and loving family, as he puts it, have forged a special bond now. Letitia, the mother, said, "I believe that we didn't meet people by accident. I feel like we've made friends for a lifetime." Just a nice little story, made those girls Christmas, something that he definitely didn't have to do, but he took many, many extra steps in order to make those girls Christmas a whole lot brighter. So congratulations to Tommy Lasorda and Alvin Bamberg as our A-listers. Kudos.
Good man.
Life's well led. Well, that about does it for us on this episode of The Populist. This was week 2 of our college football mega month. Week 3, we will not have a guest, but we will be talking about a little different topic. We'll be talking about the best college fight songs from the different universities. It's a big part of the college ambiance and the college atmosphere of the games. And so we're going to say which of the fight songs are the ones that we know the best that just are part of the fabric of college football. So tune in for that. We'll also have the poll, so you can vote on that as well. As always, we love the listeners' input. So go to populouspodcast.net to vote on the poll. Vote early, vote often, tell your friends, have them vote. The more the better. We love it.
We are nothing without you guys. So thanks for all your involvement. Populist can be found on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon, Google, iHeartRadio, Pandora, or wherever you go for your fine podcasts. We are a member of the Budsprout community, and Populist is a Vintage Year production.
That's right. And we love doing the show. We thank you all for listening. We look forward to next week. And then the final week of the Mega Month will involve the best Heisman Trophy winners of all time. So we'll talk about the best of the best. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye, everybody.
A lot of good stuff. Stay safe, everyone.
Ciao.